We're studying the book of Nehemiah, and we're in chapter 3 of the book, and this chapter really takes us all the way around the city of Jerusalem, beginning at the Sheep Gate and ending at the Sheep Gate. So Nehemiah chapter 3 is a lengthy chapter of 32 verses, and just with a quick scan, I believe that's the longest. Forget about chapter 7, which is the longest chapter in the book. But chapter 3 is really one of the longer chapters in the book, as it takes us around place by place by place, showing us all the different sections of the work being done to rebuild the walls of the city. So that's the main topic of the book of Nehemiah, is rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. Briefly reviewing that, in chapter 1 we saw how the report came to Nehemiah from his brethren that had been in Jerusalem and came back to Persian capital. Nehemiah served as the cupbearer in the court of King Artaxerxes, the Persian emperor. And so he was given this report by his brethren, fellow Israelites who had been to Jerusalem. And they were reporting on the condition of their brethren that were there, and also of the distress they were having from their enemies, and having the city of Jerusalem with its walls broken down. And so they were very vulnerable to their enemies, and facing not just opposition from them, but obvious threats to their safety. Of course, we know the temple was also located in that city, where they were, which is where God put his authority under that old covenant. And so there were many important things, necessary commandments for them to obey that required them to go to Jerusalem to the temple. So that temple had been rebuilt under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest when the first captives returned to Israel from Babylon, and that was what we read about in the book of Ezra. But we are now, we are some 70 years after the completion of the, 70 to 80 years after the completion of the temple, of the rebuilding of the temple. And so even after this time, the walls are still broken down. And those walls were destroyed by the Babylonians when they conquered, when they besieged and conquered Jerusalem, going back to 586 B.C. So at this point, it's about 140 years later. From our perspective, if we're thinking back to that time frame and what would have occurred back in, that'd be about, like the 1880s to us, something that happened in the 1880s, we would view that as being quite a long time ago from our perspective. And in terms of the history of the earth, or from God's perspective, that wouldn't be a long time, but that is a long time for Jerusalem's walls to be in a state of rubble. The city had been burnt by the Babylonians. The walls had never been rebuilt. So for it to be in that condition for that long, now for 70 of those years, the people were captives in Babylon. So it really is only after their return and rebuilding of the temple that this has now emerged as a major issue as the neighbors, the Samaritans, who were around them, who were their enemies, were causing them great distress. So there's a very urgent need now for those walls to be rebuilt for the safekeeping of the people and of the city of Jerusalem, including the temple. So Nehemiah, having heard that report, seeks from Artaxerxes the king the authorization to go do that work in rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, without which, without the authorization of the Persian government, that work can't be done. And so he received that authorization in chapter 2, and then he made the trip to Jerusalem, inspected the walls by night, and then reported to his brethren what his purpose and mission was for being there to rebuild the walls of the city. And he had the letters from the Persian government authorizing them to do that. And with that encouragement, the people were ready to do their part, and this was God's work for them to do. Now, the last part of chapter 2, we saw the first efforts the devil used to try to discourage them from doing the work before they even got started. And so we do learn a lot in Nehemiah about principles of what we need to do the Lord's work as God's people today, even though they were under a different covenant and they had a different work to do than what we have to do today as part of his church. The principles are still the same of what God would require of all of us. And so what we can see, how he used the people and blessed them in doing this particular work, we can learn a lot from what we need to do in serving him today. And as part of that also, we have the opportunity to learn a lot about the way the devil works to try to stop us from doing God's work. And so he started his first methods that he used at the end of Nehemiah chapter 2 was to scorn and mock the people for their thinking that they could do this work. And if we're concerned about the what men think, and if we have any desire for the praise and glory of men, then having people to criticize us or mock us for what we believe and what we do in following Christ today, then that could discourage us from doing that. So our shield of faith there is to remember what the Lord teaches, and not to regard what men esteem. We must not seek or receive man's praise and glory. And so what people think about what we believe and do should not have any effect on what we do. So we need to be mindful of that, because if we have any, if we're vulnerable to temptation in that area, the devil's going to be using it. And he'll have people to come at us to call us names and ridicule us and bring persecution in that way against us. And so we need to not be dissuaded in any way from doing the Lord's work because of what other people are going to say about it. And we know that this is a growing problem in our world today, the way the boldness of so many to mock Christianity and what we believe and what we're doing to serve Christ. We're going to have a lot more of that. So we need to be on the lookout for it and not be discouraged by that. We can't ever be ashamed of Christ or his gospel. What is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. The way man thinks and the way God thinks are opposite. There is also an accusation there, a false accusation, but that they were in rebellion against the government of Persia. And with the rebuilding of the temple in the book of Ezra, that same accusation was used, and then their enemies actually, and for a time, succeeded in having the government to bring a halt to the work of rebuilding the temple. So they're making that accusation against them here, that they were rebelling against the Persians to rebuild the walls of the city. Well, without the authorization of the Persian government, would the Persian rulers, could they interpret the action, if they just did this on their own to rebuild the walls of the city, that they were trying to rebuild those walls as a part of a rebellion against the Persians, so that they wouldn't have to submit to their authority, pay taxes to them, and those kinds of things, if they were doing that, if they were trying to making efforts to strengthen themselves in a physical way, well, that could be perceived as a threat. And that's why they required the authorization from the government, and they had it. So they weren't doing something, they weren't sneaking, they weren't rebelling or any of that. So they had the authority from the government. But does the devil, is he willing to try to use the authorities in the different lands where God's people are to try to cause hindrances or other problems, persecution against his church, against the Lord's church? And yes, that is the case. On this earth today, we also mentioned when we were studying that we need to pray for the authorities. The Lord teaches us to do that in 1 Timothy chapter 2, 1 through 4. For ours as well as in throughout the world, for the sake of God's people and for the furtherance of the gospel, for the salvation of those that aren't the Lord's people. But we have lots to pray for that the Lord would provide the rulers that would not cause difficulty or oppression and try to hinder us from doing the Lord's work. So we've been we need to be aware of that device that the devil uses. So then we get to chapter 3, and we're going to have a description, a detailed description of the work that now begins of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And he's going to tell us about who's doing the work where. And as we mentioned, he starts at the sheep gate in verse 1. And why was that part of the wall? You have to pick somewhere to start if you're going to say, okay, here's who's doing the work in this place. I mean, you have basically a circle. You got to pick some point in the circle to begin, and that will be where you end up if you're going to go all the way around. So this is really a tour of the work around the walls of the city. So the sheep gate is chosen as the starting and finishing place for this tour that we're taking on here in chapter 3 of the work of rebuilding Jerusalem's walls. Why was the sheep gate chosen as the beginning point here? Well, we can see in verse 1 of Nehemiah chapter 3, that Eliashib the high priest and his brethren the priests builded the sheep gate and sanctified it and set up the doors of it. So they themselves were involved in that. So the high priest was the ruler of the people. So that is chosen as the beginning place where the one that had God's authority to be the spiritual ruler of the people, and where he was involved in that work with his brethren, his fellow priests. So was the high priest, did he take part in the work? And did the other priests? Yes. And that says something. Who was exempted from this? Who was in a position where, well, they didn't really, and we pointed this out last week too, and any of us that have done any kind of, and all of us in our lives, pretty much I think everybody in here has at some point been involved in some kind of a physical job like that, and maybe even actually building some kind of a wall or something. But if you're doing this kind of work, anything to do with any type of construction or whatever, is that easy work or is that hard work? Is it clean work or is that dirty work? You're going to get scuffed up. I mean, there's going to be a lot of lifting. There's going to be a lot of physical effort involved. It's going to be a grimy work. So is the high priest going to be somebody that says, well, I've got my position to be the ruler of God's people and their spiritual guide, and I will appoint certain ones to, I'll be in charge of who gets to do the work there, but I'm not going to do it myself. I mean, would that be the right mindset? No, it wasn't. It wouldn't have been. And we can see that's pointed out in verse 1. So we actually read through verse 5 last week, so not rereading that, but from that point, He starts taking us around section by section and who's doing the work where. And he's naming people from what does stand out in those other verses until we get to verse 5. Is these are people from other towns and cities throughout Judea. So the captives have resettled the land. They're not all in Jerusalem. I mean, that's the most prominent city, the capital city, and where the temple is. But the inhabitants of the land are in other towns and villages. They're all here. I mean, who of God's people would have an interest in, or should have an interest in, the well-being of the city of Jerusalem where God's temple was and where many of their brethren would live? Would the right attitude for an Israelite at this time to be, well, that's Jerusalem's problem. Whoever lives there, they can do it. No, this is the city where God placed his authority. So as servants of that God, the God of heaven, for them at this time, whose concern was it of the well-being of the city of Jerusalem? It was all of theirs. And they're all there. So all of these Jews from that are in the land and from all these towns, everybody is involved in this work of the Lord together. All right, any lesson for us there? Well, from verse 1, any of us above a particular work of the Lord where we're above having to do that? Is there any job too lowly? Is there any job too grimy? Do we consider ourselves too good or too important for any work that is to be done? Or if there's a need for work, are we willing to do it, whatever it is? And no matter how lowly or grimy the job is, well, yes, we should be willing to do that. And I mean, this was good enough for the high priest to be involved in. And also, should we also not have the attitude, I mean, of God's work overall? Do we have, for example, any interest in the furtherance of the gospel and its spread to all regions of this earth? Or do we feel like, well, if in those other lands, that's their problem and it's their job to find a way to figure out how to hear the gospel on their own? I mean, would that be the right approach to that? Or have we been told and taught to go into all the world and preach the gospel, and if we're not in the position to personally go, that we have a part in sending the ones that will be going? Do we all have a responsibility in that work to make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever Christ has commanded us? That's, of course, Matthew chapter 28, 19 and 20. Yes, we all have our part in that. It's a commandment for us all. So God's work, even if it's in a place where we don't live, it is our concern if we have the right mind, isn't it? So that we can see that same point or principle here. If it's God's work, we need to be concerned about it. If we have an opportunity to be involved in that work and help that work, it shouldn't matter to us where we live. We need to do what opportunity we have that has been given to us of the Lord to help in his work, wherever that work is. All right, so we get to verse 5. And this is where we got started a little bit last week, but had to stop. But it says, "And next unto them the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles put not their necks to the work of their Lord." We mentioned Tekoa. That's one of the towns in Judea. It's rather nondescript in the sense of, in the scriptures, if you do a search of Tekoa, we don't read about any major any events that occur there that are recorded in the scriptures. No battles there, no other events that occurred in that place. Really, the only thing noteworthy about Tekoa other than this, it's the city of the prophet Amos. So that's mentioned in the first verse of the book of Amos. So that's really the only noteworthy thing about Tekoa in the Old Testament, that it's the hometown of Amos the prophet, other than what it says about their nobles in verse 5 of Nehemiah chapter 3. So here's this town in Judea, like there are many other towns are represented by the workers in these different sections that we're reading about in this chapter. But there is something very different about what it says of these Tekoites here in verse 5. The Tekoites repaired. So did, as far as the inhabitants of that little town as a whole, are the people saying, nah, we're not getting involved in that? Or are they there and being present and participating in that work like all the other towns too? They are, with the exception of their nobles. Their nobles put not their necks to the work of their Lord. Now this also tells us whose work this is. This is God's work for them. Who is the one that has given them this job to do? It's God. So this is, we need to remember that, don't we? And whatever we've been given an opportunity to do, if it's a good work, if it's fulfilling the Lord's will, it's His work. And He's giving us showing us His favor to be able to be involved in His work. And we need to show our appreciation for that by giving our all to doing whatever that work is that He's given us to do there. Well, look at these nobles. This is God's work, but they're not putting their necks to the work of their Lord. Now, what's the obvious problem here? Why is it pointed out these are the nobles? Why are they different than all the rest of their fellow Tekoites? Well, they're nobility. These are the high and mighty of the town. So these would be the powerful, the rich ones in the town. And what do they think about getting their hands into? They might get scratches on their knuckles if they're involved in work like that. They could break a nail. This could be tragic, couldn't it? There's obviously some attitude that they have that they're not getting down into the grime and doing work like that. Do they consider themselves too good for this kind of lowly job to do? Very obviously. Now, we already have seen the example in verse 1 where the high priest was and the other priests were there doing the work. Why are these Tekoite nobles, what's so good or special about them that they don't need to be involved in this work? They're being singled out here. We're told about this for a reason. And it's not. And this is not to their honor that it's mentioned there. And even the very language of it, they would put not their necks to the work of their Lord. This is their God and His work, and they're considering themselves too good in some fashion for whatever this job is. Is this humility or is this pride? This is pride. Now, we need to be on guard against this. I mean, can people think that way? Well, somebody else can do that. I'm not doing that. Yeah. And there are going to be lots of jobs that we might not particularly like. I remember growing up when I'd have chores to do. It never really bothered me to mow the grass. Some people probably just hate that. I couldn't stand raking. I still don't like that, but it's just, because you could practically just see the leaves falling again while you're raking. I guess somebody could point out, well, you can almost see the grass growing where you're mowing it, but I mean, I don't know, but it's just, I never, that raking just always was something that was the chore that I liked the least. But when the yard needs to be raked, what do you got to do? The job's there that needs to be done, you got to do it. So even if it's a work that you don't really necessarily like doing, if it's the Lord's work, we should be thankful and willing to do that, not despise that. Now, we already saw this particular issue in another application of it with the rebuilding of the temple. When the temple was being rebuilt, yeah, Brother Michael? It sure does. And one place that we saw that when we were studying the book of Ezra when they were rebuilding the temple, and without going back and reading all of that now, the second temple that was built by the captives from Babylon that returned, how did it compare in the physical sense to Solomon's temple, the original? There was no comparison. It was much, much smaller in size. Now, over time, eventually, there was a lot of enhancement to that building that occurred later, especially under Herod the Great, which that's after where we finish up reading in the book of Malachi, which is close to around this period when Nehemiah was there. So when we get into the 5th century B.C. is where we... That's the last, chronologically, the last period of time that we read about in the Scriptures. And then we get to that period that's called Between the Testaments, and the next thing we're reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Gospel accounts, where about John the Baptist and the birth of Christ, and then everything from there. So we do have a period of a little over 400 years that's a gap as far as the records in the Scriptures. Well, there were plenty of things happened during that time, but one of the things that happened is the Herods came on the scene as local rulers under the Romans, and Herod the First, also called Herod the Great, did a lot of enhancements to the temple and expanded it and beautified it and things like that. So that's why we read when they were pointing out to Jesus the magnificent stones of the temple. But when they first rebuilt it back under Zerubbabel and Joshua, it didn't look so magnificent, especially in comparison to Solomon's temple. And there were still some around at that time that remembered Solomon's temple, and some of them wept when they saw it, because it was nothing like the first. So one of the things that we read, for one thing, in Haggai and Zechariah were two prophets that were there with the people. The Lord put them there, used them at that very time when they were doing that work of the Lord and rebuilding the temple. Use those two prophets to encourage the people in doing the Lord's work of rebuilding that temple. And concerning the physical inferiority of that second temple, especially as when it was first built, Haggai chapter 2, the Lord told them to do the work and build, and he said he was going to give a glory to that second house that exceeded that of the first. And that was going to be a spiritual glory, and it pertained to, there was prophecy there of the ultimate sending of Christ. God's Son taught, eventually came, and he taught in that temple and did many wonderful works, miracles there. Who had ever been at God's temple or taught in it or did anything in it that compared to what Jesus, God's own Son? So God did bring a glory there to fulfill that. So course, that was 500 years, more than 500 years into the future for the ones who were doing the work. And one of the principles we considered there is whatever work God gives us now, do we really even know or comprehend exactly how God is going to give increase to that work and what it's going to, what he's going to do with that as far as impacting others or down the line into the future? Do we have sight of all of that? And what looks at, we might look at a little work here and think, this isn't anything. But what is it to God? And what is he doing with that? And, I mean, there could be something that God uses that work to his glory that's far beyond anything that we can comprehend at the time we're doing that. Isn't that true? I mean, that was the case there. So really, who are we to judge the work God gives us in terms of its value with what little we can see anyhow? And fact is, as Brother Michael was pointing out, if God's given us the work to do, we need to be very, very thankful for that, no matter what it is. And in the book of Zechariah, again, Zechariah was there with Haggai, with the people, and this is exactly about that work of rebuilding the temple, in addressing that problem that some had when they were doing that work, and they considered it to be so insignificant because that second temple just looked like nothing compared to the first. So in Zechariah chapter 4, verse 10, he said, "For who hath despised the day of small things? For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those seven. They are the eyes of the Lord which run to and fro through the whole earth." Who has despised the day of small things? Well, who thought of it as a day of small things? Well, certain of the people, God's people, that was their attitude. Not all of them, but that was the attitude of some towards that work when they were seeing what they were actually doing. And they thought it was something small. And they despised it. Well, should we judge that way? Is there any work that God gives us to do that we should judge as small and then discount them? That's really what despising is, to count as nothing. But to discount that work, to not be pleased or encouraged to do that work because of how we judge that work to be in terms of its significance, its size or importance. We can't be like that. So this is a related application, what we were seeing with those Tekoites there in Nehemiah chapter 3 and verse 5. We shouldn't judge God's work. Well, that's too small for me. I don't want that. I despise that. I mean, we don't want to be thinking that in any way at any time. A good example, a couple from the New Testament, some passages to look at to help us with this. Also, 2 Corinthians chapter 8. This is when the Lord had commanded the people to give. There were needy saints in Jerusalem at this time and in the first century A.D. And so here were Christians in Judea that had physical needs. Well, the churches in other areas, such as in Asia Minor, Macedonia, Achaia, where Corinth was, they were all encouraged to lay by in store as God had prospered. And that's the context, actually, where we have that command in 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, that we very often and appropriately use, because it is a commandment that extends to us upon the first day of the week, which is every first day of the week. We are to lay by in store as God has prospered us for his work. But that was the specific context when he gave that command originally to the churches. It was for those needy saints in Jerusalem that they were, or Judea, that they were going to be helping. When he's with this inspired epistle to the church at Corinth here in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, he's actually using the example of their brethren in Macedonia to encourage them to give liberally and joyfully to this work. And so at the beginning of 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1, he says, "Moreover, brethren, We do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, how that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. For to their power I bear record, yea, and beyond their power, they were willing of themselves, praying us with much entreaty that we would receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. And this they did, not as we hoped, but first gave their own selves to the Lord and unto us by the will of God. So he was using these brethren as an example. This is the right attitude to have towards God's work. Well, they didn't have much materially, but they gave not just, they gave beyond as far as what they had and what would be expected for what they might be able to do in this work. They did much beyond any of that. And this is the opposite of the way things might tend to go. Instead of them being having to be cajoled into, give more, why don't you give more? They're actually are the ones that are entreating and encouraging Paul. No, take this. I mean, they were obviously feeling a little bit bad about how much these ones who didn't have a lot were giving. And they were insisting that they receive their offering. So, I mean, how often does that happen? Where the ones giving are having to assure the ones that it's going to be helping that, we want you to take this. But that's what was happening here. But how it's described in verse 1 is what they understood. We do you to wit to know, he says, of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia. This opportunity to give to this work was given by whom? Who was bestowing it? See, this isn't about the Macedonians. Verse 1 is not about the Macedonian brethren bestowing their offering for the ones who had need. It's that God was bestowing his favor upon them for the opportunity for them to give. God was doing them a favor. Well, whose work is it? God's? Does God have to include us in his work? This is our creator, the creator and ruler of the universe that has so many magnificent works that are for his eternal glory. And for him to give us an opportunity, for him to be telling us, okay, I would like to use you and I'm going to give you an opportunity to participate in my work. I mean, that's a favor from him that he's giving to us to be able to do any job. And if we understand it that way, would we regard anything as being, well, that's too small for me to do? We should be appreciative of every opportunity God gives us to do any good thing. Whether it's to do a sink full of dishes or whatever it is. I mean, or rake leaves in my case, but whatever it is. I mean, those jobs that we might not really like to do, if we understand that, well, this is a good work for the Lord and he's given me the opportunity to that, and he's showing me his favor to let me do this. Well, this also then would require us to have the mind that the Macedonians had to recognize or understand it this way and to be willing to do that. And they were willing of themselves. That was the first part. But why? What, verse 5 is the key there. They first gave their own selves to the Lord. If we give ourselves to God, then whatever he gives us to do to serve him, are we going to question it at all? Are we going to judge that work or condemn that work, despise that work, or consider ourselves to be too important in any way for that work? Not if we've given ourselves to him and we recognize this is his favor on us to give us the opportunity to do that. Now we can see that understanding with these brethren there in that were doing this work there in the time of Nehemiah and rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, but those nobles of Tekoa did not have that proper understanding and mind about that work. John chapter 13. This chapter should forever settle it for us as far as any work that God gives us to do for us, if we ever are considering a work too gross, too lowly, too dirty, nasty, or whatever it is, and just, I'm not doing that. I'll do a lot of things, but I'm not doing that. I mean, if we're going to even be tempted to think that way, or to think ourselves to be too important for anything, well, John 13, this chapter, the first part, I mean, this chapter, when you hear John 13, there are a couple of things that might jump right into our minds just hearing that chapter. I mean, this is the chapter, the end of it, where it gives the new commandment for us to love one another as Christ has loved us. Well, that's going to be, a lot of that's based in what he's telling us about at the beginning of the chapter. This is the chapter, the beginning of John 13, tells us about Jesus and washing his disciples' feet. And of the custom of that time, people didn't, they didn't walk out of their air-conditioned houses down their swept sidewalk to get in their cars with their nice shoes on and then turn on their air conditioner in their car and then drive to their place. And then that's not the way it was for most people there. That's not the way it is for most people in a lot of places, even to right now. How do people get around? Not everybody had their own chariot in their garage in Israel, you know, back here in this time. I mean, how did people get around? I mean, they walked. What were the roads like? Were they nice, clean, paved roads that the city had their cleaners out keeping all dirt off of it all the time for them? No. I mean, these were dirt roads that people walked in. What kind of footwear did they have? They had sandals. If you've ever worn a pair of those, you ever done this, you can go there. And I remember, and I know Caleb will tell you all about it too, but, you know, being in India, I mean, I wore... Pretty much everybody over there is you wear chapels. I mean, they're open toed, they're sandals, right? I mean, and it's much like, I mean, it's going right back to this time. And lots of the road, there's dirt everywhere, and people walk everywhere. I mean, that's a common way to get around. Your feet are filthy when you spend any time doing that. This is the context of John 13. I mean, I didn't even like washing my own feet when after a day of that kind of thing. But, I mean, how would you like to wash a room full of people's feet when they've been out on the roads with their sandals on all day? I mean, it would be filthy. I mean, filthy, grimy feet. I mean, that there aren't a lot of things that sound less appealing than doing that work to clean feet like that, is there? And this is the Son of God. This is the point. God's own Son was doing that, and was doing that for a reason, which he concludes in verse 12 when he says, "So after that he'd washed their feet and had taken his garments and was set down again, he said unto them, Know you what I have done to you? You call me Master and Lord, and you say, Well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. Well, is Christ our Master and Lord? If he would do a work like that, and we're saying he's our Master, then is there any work that we shouldn't be willing to do? A work that's not too good for, or too lowly for him, and we're going to say it's too lowly for us? I mean, who are we compared to the Son of God? Our Master, our own Lord, our Maker, and he did that. There's nothing that we shouldn't be willing to do, and that's what he's telling us there and teaching by that example. And he says in verse 15, "For I've given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, neither is he that is sent greater than he that sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them." We're not greater than he is. We need to understand that, but of course then he says we're blessed if we do it. Not just agree to it in principle. We need to do that to start, but then we need to do it. So if we recognize him as our Lord and Master and we give ourselves to him, then whatever by his favor he gives us to do, we should be willing to do and do it with all of our heart, heartily to the Lord. That's the last passage we want to look at here before we close in Colossians chapter 3. How we do this work that God gives us. Colossians 3, verses 23 and 24, he says, "And whatsoever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men, knowing that of the Lord you shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ." That's who we're serving. It's a favor he's given us to be able to do any work for him. Furthermore, on top of that, he says he's going to eternally reward us for any of those works that we do that he gives us the opportunity to do. We need to do everything we do for him heartily as serving him. And if we have that, understanding and have that right mind, we're going to be full of zeal to do any and all the works. And if we all do that together as they were doing there in Jerusalem, the Lord can do give increase and do great things through us for his glory that way. And we'll get to see the results of that and how he did that with them in rebuilding the walls of the city. Aside from that poor attitude of the Tekoite nobles, the rest of them didn't have that attitude. And there, that one exception is pointed out for a reason, and we don't want to be like that in any way. All right, so we'll stop there, and Lord willing, we'll continue verse 6 and cover some ground in chapter 3, Lord willing, next Lord's Day. But let's go to our Heavenly Father in prayer as we close.